For the Love of Dogs, Community, and Independence, A Profile of the GSGDHI Affiliate. By Susan Glass. The academic disciplines of community studies and service learning both define the word community as a group of individuals brought together by common interests, common needs, and common problems. This strikes me as a pretty good definition of active CCB affiliates, and one of our most active is Golden State Guide Dog Handlers Inc., or GSGDHI. The 55 members of this affiliate constitute community at its best. They group themselves around common interests, their guide dogs, their connections to guide dog puppy raisers, their guide dog schools, their experiences of life and travel, and their guide dog lifestyle advocacy. These interests often morph into needs and problems which the members of GSGDHI address together. Pick up your virtual harness handle, and join me on a brisk tail-wagging journey with this enthusiastic and productive CCB community. And since I am an active member of GSGDHI, I am taking the liberty of writing in first-person plural for the remainder of this article. The members of GSGDHI come from every region of California, and you might wonder how we stay connected throughout the year, especially since CCB now has only one annual convention. The answer? Dynamic year-round programs, knowledgeable legislative awareness and advocacy, ongoing member recruitment, a virtual member lounge, a thriving chat list, enthusiastic officers and board members, and a newsletter to which many members contribute their voices. Programs. Masterfully chaired by GSGDHI Vice President Mail George, the program committee sponsored 5 events for GSGDHI members in 2019. 3 happened over the telephone and Zoom platform, 1 took place on the GSGDHI chat list, and 1 was offered during the CCB convention in Fresno. David Jackson, Tony Eames, GSGDHI President Alice Turner, Charlene Ornelas, and Susan Glass all serve on this committee. The January program was titled Ring in the New Year with Play. Mark Hines, from the Kong Company, was the guest speaker. He talked about how play, along with various kinds of toys, helps handlers and dogs bond with one another, relieve stress, and allow dogs to exercise their intelligence. The call was well attended by GSGDHI members. The next program took place on the GSGDHI chat list, and was called What I Wish I Knew Before I Trained with My First Guide Dog. You may recall reading the article in the summer 2019 BC that grew out of that program. The article was titled 14 Things I Wish I Knew Before Training with My First Dog. In late April, representatives from a variety of guide dog schools joined us over the telephone to provide updates on their training programs, and give us guidance on preparing emotionally and physically for training with our successor guide dogs at any age. Then on June 8 at the CCB convention in Fresno, local experts in nutrition, supplements, and alternative medicine for guide dogs addressed our affiliate. This program came about because Tony Eames knew a veterinarian who was also knowledgeable about alternative and holistic medicine for dogs. Our most recent program, again held over the telephone, happened on November 4. Greg Steinmetz, Admissions and Graduate Services Manager from Guide Dogs of America, and Don Moles, graduate of the Leader Dogs O&M Guide Dog Training Program, addressed us on the topic, Do Technology and Guide Dog Travel Mix? The array of accessible GPS technology tools now available to blind and visually impaired people presents guide dog handlers with new opportunities and challenges. How do you juggle your Victor Trek or your Era phone with your earbuds, your guide dog harness, your folding cane, your purse, your note taker, and everything else that you are carrying? Is it safe to listen to an Era assistant or soundscape app while also focusing on your dog? At what point should you introduce navigation technology into your guide work? We discussed these and more questions during our call, and as you might expect, responses varied, but we all learned a lot. The lounges. Our rich program schedule is possible because several members of GSGDHI are well established in the greater national guide dog community, where they have forged deep and lasting connections with guide dog instructors, veterinarians, and other experts. The play program happened because members of the program committee knew Mark Hines, and his Kong products had been featured at several CCB guide dog convention programs. We also get program ideas through our member lounge calls. Whereas program calls feature guest speakers and moderated discussions, lounge calls are informal and open to guide dog handlers who live outside of California and are not necessarily members of GSGDHI. We hold lounge calls on the first Wednesday of every other month and talk about whatever participants want to discuss. One night we talked about how to handle Uber and Lyft drivers who are reluctant to transport our dogs. Another time we talked about working with members of the public who question the manner in which we are handling our dogs. We've shared tips on dog diets, alternative medicine and grooming. We've helped each other through days when nothing in dog travel seemed to go right. We've celebrated the arrival of new guides and mourned the passing of beloved guide companions. Lounge calls are warm and friendly. If we were physically together, we'd be sipping wine or coffee. I believe that they are an integral part of what keeps our affiliate vital and connected. Advocacy. Gil Johnson and Diane Deutsch co-chaired GSGD's Advocacy Task Force, and this year, they and we have much to celebrate. Following a prolonged and rigorous letter-writing campaign and lobbying of legislators, IB 169 was finally signed by the governor. This law gives owners of guide dogs and schools providing instruction to puppies who are in the early stages of their training, recourse to receive compensation if the dog is attacked. If a guide dog or puppy in training is attacked by someone's unruly pet animal, the guide dog handler or puppy raiser can seek compensation for the dog's medical treatment, and for time taken away from guide work while both handler and dog heal from the experience. Margie Donovan was the leader of the pack in helping getting this bill passed after a three-year campaign. Though Margie and Gil spearheaded this legislative effort, the final victory happened because so many GSGDHI members lent their support. This is a clear case of a community working together to solve a problem. Membership. GSGDHI's membership committee is co-chaired by Bob Acosta, and me, Susan Glass. Its other members are GSGD President Alice Turner, Tony Eames, Christy Crespin, and Nellie Emerson. Our first goal in 2019 was the creation of an enrollment form for prospective members. We thank President Alice Turner and Treasurer Vita Zavalli for their timely assistance. Our second goal, on which we are still working, is to create two self-satisfaction surveys. The first survey will be distributed to current GSGDHI members in January of 2020. The second survey will be sent to the entire California Council of the Blind membership to find those who are guide dog handlers but who have not joined GSGDHI. The survey subcommittee is chaired by Christy Crespin. One of our projects was to create a GSGDHI logo, and there's a heartwarming story worth telling here. The artist who was designing our logo wanted to be sure she captured the realistic look of a dog in harness, and for that she needed a model. One of our members, Michelle McGrew, had a photo of her recently deceased guide dog Garvey that was taken on his 11th birthday. The photo showed him in full harness with Michelle beside him in proper position. Based on this photograph, the artist created an excellent GSGDHI logo which will appear on our newsletter, and on any publicity materials that we distribute. In this way, Garvey's legacy continues. He was a special guy anyway. He starred as Helen Keller's pet dog in the play The Miracle Worker, that was presented over a year ago by the Tabard Theater Company in San Jose, California. Our dogs are always our living legacy. How fitting that we can honor the life of one of them in such a public way. President of GSGDHI, Alice Turner, shares her thoughts about the success of GSGD. GSGD is thriving as an affiliate because there are so many opportunities for involvement and leadership. Our committee chairs know how to harness the skills and talents of our members, and together they achieve amazing results. GSGDHI board members are committed to support the community and to identify a path for all to be involved in a way that is meaningful for each member. Most of all, we are a community who share a common passion about the guide dog lifestyle. Our tagline is Forward Together. And this really sums up our affiliate. GSGDHI invites any CCB member with a dog guide to consider joining our affiliate. And if you don't yet have a dog, but are considering the guide dog lifestyle, please reach out to us. I will end this article by providing contact information for KJSGD members who will gladly respond to your inquiries. Contact information. President, Alice Turner. AliceM1957@comcast.net. Vice President, Mail George. MailG921@gmail.com. Secretary, Vivian Younger. Younger.Vivian@gmail.com. Treasurer, Vita Zavoli. VZAVioli@gmail.com. GSGDHI Board Members. Diane Deutsch. DianeDeutsch07@gmail.com. William Elliott. BrettsYuki@gmail.com. Active Shooter Drill, A Patient's Perspective. By Bev Clifford. Editor's Note, Bev is a member of the Silicon Valley chapter, and, during our October program, we had a story hour called Wow, or the World According to Us, and Bev told this story. This event demonstrates that visually impaired people can live rich, adventurous lives, and I think Wow should be part of your chapter activity. As a member of Kaiser San Jose's Member Patient Advisory Council, MPAC, I recently had the opportunity to participate in one of Kaiser's quarterly disaster drills, to prepare hospital staff for the sudden and unexpected intake of patients in an emergency. This is the story of my experience. At 5 p.m. on a warm Thursday afternoon, September 26, 2019, I arrived at the ambulance bay just outside the emergency room entrance at Kaiser San Jose, and was greeted enthusiastically by the coordinator of the drill. She explained that a call had gone out for doctors of every stripe, along with nurses, pharmacists, and any other available staff members, to take time away from their busy schedules and volunteer for the evening's proceedings, which, believe me, isn't always easy for them to do, as nursing care, operations, and emergencies are still going on in the hospital in real time. Some of the staff were asked to gather outside in the ambulance bay to do triage as patients arrived, and they would be in constant radio contact with others who would remain inside the hospital to give vital information and consultation as needed. There were plastic chairs arranged all around the ambulance bay, each section of chairs having a different designation: triage, X-ray, operating room, and so on. There weren't as many volunteer patients as Kaiser would have liked, so several chairs were occupied by teddy bears and other stuffed animals as stand-ins. Some patients were the children of participating hospital staff members, which added a bit of lightness and humor to the otherwise serious nature of the drill. All I knew when I arrived was that my job was to be one of several volunteer patients, so I was interested to learn just what that would mean. A friendly gentleman ushered me to one of the plastic chairs, where the evening's scenario was explained. We patients had been at a football game at a San Jose high school when suddenly some crazed person with a gun showed up and started shooting at us. In order for the doctors to know exactly where I had been shot, another gentleman created a wound site by wrapping several thick layers of gauze around my waist, and painting them with something like red dye number 2, the wound looked quite authentic. The kids got a big kick out of this part of the drill, as some of them got their faces painted, and others had fake bloody bandages wrapped around their arms or legs. Once I had a bona fide wound, I needed identification, so someone put a lanyard around my neck to which was attached a huge cardboard placard with all my stats, so that the doctors could immediately see who I was and how I had been wounded. According to my placard, I was now Natalie Jong, a 29-year-old woman who was 32 weeks pregnant, and I had been shot in the abdomen. Now the really interesting part of the drill commenced. I wasn't sure how much the doctors knew about my condition, as no one had thought to read aloud what was on my placard. But from what I did know, I figured I could act the part and improvise as I chose. So when hospital staff came over to check me out, I started yelling, "It hurts. It really hurts. Okay, this patient obviously needs drugs. But which ones?" This called for the doctors to consult with a pharmacist, who recommended that I be given Dilaudid, and I know that stuff's really good, because several years ago in real life I dislocated my shoulder, and Dilaudid put me straight into La La Land, and I went from pain to fun. Before they injected me, however, I kept moaning, "My baby. Save my baby. Don't give me anything that will hurt my baby." And they promised me that they wouldn't. Then I thought to myself, In my real life past, when I lose blood in one accident or another, I get lightheaded and start feeling a little weak. Wouldn't Natalie have that reaction, too? So I told my doctors that I was feeling lightheaded. They immediately started asking me questions: was I dizzy? Did I feel nauseated? Dizzy. I croaked. And then things got exciting. My vital signs were suddenly worse, and since the doctors attending me could see that there was an entrance wound but no visible exit wound, this fact was worrisome. It meant that I was probably bleeding internally. Now what to do? Another urgent consultation. I needed to go to the operating room ASAP. Not only that, but they'd have to take the baby. Oh no, I'm only 32 weeks along. I shrieked in despair. But wait. Was there even an operating room available? Legitimate question, since operations were still being performed in the hospital in real time. Whew. There was a room. At this point, I was shepherded to a second chair in the operating room section of the ambulance bay, where more consultation ensued. Once the operation began and they could see what was going on inside, they found out where the internal bleeding was. My spleen had been severely damaged and they couldn't repair it, so it had to be removed, which stopped the bleeding. Well, that was okay, because a person can live without a spleen, apparently. When they were through with me in the operating room, I was told that I had survived and, miracle of miracles, so had my baby and it was a boy. In the meantime, other doctors were doing triage on other patients, and I had to go to another chair far from the action because they were through dealing with Natalie. So I, Bev, sat for a quiet time waiting for the next thing to happen, and gratefully eating a bit of a snack, as I hadn't had supper yet. While I waited, there was a short debriefing, a discussion among the doctors of what had occurred with all the other patients, which I was too far away to hear. I thought perhaps my job was done. But I was wrong. After a bit, I was directed to a second triage chair, my Natalie placard was removed, and I was issued a second placard and became Nicole Taylor, a 41-year-old woman who had been shot in the ankle. I was definitely in pain, and had no compunction about letting everybody know this, so again, Dilaudid was prescribed. It was obvious to the doctors that my ankle was not only bleeding, but was also dangerously deformed, and the skin of my foot was very pale, an indication of decreased circulation. Through my protestations of pain, I could hear them discussing whether or not they needed to reduce my foot, or if I might need something called a CT angio. Reduce my foot? What in blazes did that mean? Were they planning to make it smaller somehow, maybe cut something off? Having no idea what they were talking about, and figuring that Natalie would certainly want to know, I hysterically demanded to be told what a foot reduction meant, and then what in the world was a CT angio? Patiently the doctors answered my questions. Reducing my foot meant putting my ankle back into its proper position, to see if I would get circulation back in my foot. If the skin remained pale, they would know that one or both of the two arteries that serve the ankle were damaged or perhaps destroyed, in which case they would need to do a CT angio to assess the damage. But if they reduced my foot and the skin returned to its usual hue, they would know that the circulation hadn't been affected by the gunshot. They were hoping that at least one of the arteries was still functional, because you need one artery to be working for normal circulation to occur. If there was only one artery left and it was damaged, they'd have to figure out a way to fix it. When it was finally decided to reduce my foot, they injected me with a second drug, from which I deduced that the pain of foot reduction must be excruciating. This time they didn't need to move me to a different chair because they could do the work right where we were situated. When they were through, I learned that I was again a very fortunate patient, my circulation had returned to normal, and no arteries seemed to have been impaired. Therefore, no other treatment would be needed at that time except for pain management, and they could proceed to a new patient who might be far worse off than I was. Since the doctors were again finished with me, I thought I might be free to leave, but instead I sat relaxing for a while as other patients were dealt with. Little by little, they began leaving the ambulance bay for home, and soon I was the only one left. I was then informed that there would be a final debriefing, and I was welcome to listen in and give a patient's perspective on the experience. Thus, I was privileged to hear feedback from the entire medical staff about what had worked well in the drill, what hadn't worked quite so well, and what improvements needed to be made in future. I found this fascinating. And when I was asked for input, I was happy to report that the medical professionals involved in my care had been kind, patient, willing to answer my anxious questions, and concerned about how I was feeling and what I was experiencing. I was able to listen in while they consulted with one another and with the inside hospital personnel, and from my vantage point it seemed that they had been thorough, and were working as conscientiously as possible to ascertain the best and most effective treatments. You may wonder why I didn't make a point of the fact that I was a blind patient. I did consider doing this, but realized at the outset that these people were concentrating with all their might to do the best job they could in the face of this disaster, and throwing a disability at them right then wouldn't be the best option. If I participate in future drills, I can then ask the coordinators if it would be helpful for the staff to know in advance that a patient has a disability, and that information could appear on the person's placard along with all the other necessary stats. All in all, the drill was a great learning experience for me, and I know that Kaiser appreciated my participation and input.